This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now an online store with the new Squarespace Commerce feature. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK4.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 93, 3-inch heels and a 6-inch hairdo. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the arrival of TNG HD on iTunes and Amazon, a reunion of the full Enterprise principal cast, TV Guide's Trek Love, the best Star Trek audiobooks, new Into Darkness posters, and Cumberbatch's latest Harrison hints. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and Larry Nemechek to discuss the making of the classic DS9 episode, Trials and Tribulations. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. How are you doing this week?
Doing pretty well, Chris. Had a great Sunday here. It was beautiful outside. Spent a lot of the day at the park, just enjoying the weather. Then we went to this place called Bahama Bucks, where they do great shaved ice. And so warm enough to be able to do those kind of things without being hot enough that we don't want to be outside. So really just a pleasant day for me. What about you, Chris?
That's pretty good. I don't think that shaved ice is something that I would be quite into right now. You know, it may be April 15th here, but it's kind of cold. I don't know what's going on. I keep hoping it's going to warm up. I feel like every time we do a podcast, we talk about how the weather is really messed up these days, and it really is here. So I'm going to pass on the shaved ice, but maybe I'll have a nice cup of, you know, hot Ractigino or something later on after the show, and that'll be perfect for me. Just coming out of a busy weekend, you know, so much to do, editing a lot of shows, but now ready to talk Star Trek news. So let's jump into that. And the first story that we have up is one that, you know, on the surface, this might seem like, okay, well, big deal. Star Trek's been in iTunes, but TNG seasons 1 and 2 are now available in HD via iTunes and Amazon Instant Video. And this is a big deal because until now, TNG hasn't been in iTunes at all.
Yeah, this is really cool. That and, I mean, just the idea that, you know, if you're a Prime member already with Amazon and you could be streaming right now seasons 1 and 2, you know, Prime membership is $79. Each one of these seasons is almost that much money. So alone to just be able to do that for a year is awesome. And then if you decide that you want these seasons digitally, you can go both ways. It's a perfect idea, I think, for those people that are on the go and they want to be able to watch their shows on the go as well. And, you know, a lot of people, this is a lot better deal, you know, to go digital now. And so, you know, with iPads, I was watching an episode of Deep Space Nine on my iPad just through Netflix the other day. And oh my goodness, it looked so good, you know, and it's just SD, you know, from Netflix, but it looks fantastic on my Retina screen. It almost looks HD without being HD. So to get these new episodes of The Next Generation in HD, I think would be fantastic through iTunes or, you know, Amazon Prime.
Yeah, having it on the go like that is pretty cool. We don't have Netflix in Japan, but we have Hulu, and Hulu here has the original series and Enterprise. And so one day I'm out, I'm having lunch at McDonald's. I'm like, what do I want to do? So I just pulled out my iPhone and I just pulled up an episode of Enterprise, sat there and watched it streaming straight to my iPhone, and it was fantastic. So yeah, digital is a great way to go if you just want to watch the episodes. Now for me, I like to have all the extras, because I've seen all these episodes so many times. what I'm especially interested in are the additional commentaries, the, you know, cast interviews, all the extra stuff that you get on the Blu-rays. So I like to pick up the discs myself, but I do think it's really exciting to see The Next Generation in iTunes. I don't know what the arrangement is in terms of licensing, because if I remember, and I could be wrong here, but going way back when Star Trek first started appearing in iTunes, I feel like The Next Generation was there briefly and then it was gone. But I could be wrong and it may have never been there. But all the other series have been there pretty much all along. They added them, you know, bit by bit, but you've got everything in there except The Next Generation. So there must be some sort of licensing deal where they had given certain networks or certain services the right to carry The Next Generation. iTunes just couldn't work that out. But finally, it's there. You can get the complete season one for $69.99 and the complete season two for $58.99. Or you can get individual episodes for $2.99. And the pricing is exactly the same on iTunes and on Amazon for digital. But of course, Matthew, as you said, if you have Amazon Prime, $79 for the year, you can stream both seasons of this plus all the other shows they have. So that's a fantastic deal. We unfortunately don't have that option in Japan. We have Amazon Prime, but it doesn't include any kind of video streaming like it does for you guys over there. So it's not, and everything here comes next day pretty much anyway, because the geography is very compressed. So it's not really a big benefit, you know, for me to have Amazon Prime.
Right. What do you think that season one cost more than season two? Do you think that that's because generally everyone knows the quality of season one is actually better than season two?
I don't know. I mean, there are fewer episodes in season two. That's the season two set has typically been less expensive than season one. Again, if I recall, not the retail price, I guess, because they tend to flatten those out on the DVD releases, but you would sometimes find season two for less. I don't know. It might also be that, you know, season two is not really a fan favorite. It's the Pulaski season. And then there has been all the word of, you know, the talk, like you were just mentioning, about the remastering quality.
Right.
And some of the shortcomings in season two, which haven't really bothered me personally, but I know that for those who were looking for some very specific things out of the remastering, compared to season one, and compared to what we have been seeing coming out in the upcoming season three release, it is a little bit disappointing compared to the other two, although still a big improvement over the DVDs.
Well, and definitely season three looks to really take what season one did and just almost in some ways blow it out of the water. So I'm very excited for season three. I think it's going to be fantastic. And I'll get to experience that a little bit when I go see The Best of Both Worlds in theaters in a few weeks. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, I'm jealous about that. I can't do that. I do have season three and The Best of Both Worlds Blu-rays pre-ordered, and they actually were released at separate times for pre-order, and I had ordered them individually. So I went back, canceled both orders, reordered them together so that I only have to pay shipping once, because for me, shipping costs more than the Best of Both Worlds Blu-ray itself costs.
That's so really funny.
That separately. Yeah, that's the case. So anyway, we'll put links to all this in the show notes if you want to hop over and grab these on iTunes. And it's just nice to see The Next Generation available on iTunes at last, so we can finally flesh out and complete the entire Star Trek family there on iTunes. Matthew, while we're talking about Blu-rays, you and I, both big Enterprise fans, and the TNG Season 2 Blu-ray that we were just talking about has a very, very popular extra on it, which is this entire cast reunion of the entire Next Generation cast. And they're doing something similar for Enterprise.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see this. I would hoped that they would have had this on season one, but I think the time that they were creating the season one extras was a little compressed. And so they really are going to, I think, give us what we all had hoped and to see the cast reunion of Enterprise. And this was a great cast. I mean, one, it's pretty much a great looking cast across the board, really. And then two, to get to see these people come back after 10 years and talk about their characters and maybe some of the things they might wanted to have seen, especially that they're going to be along with, hopefully Brandon Braga is in the picture. So I'm hoping he will be there with them as well, maybe even doing the interview.
I'm pretty sure he'll be there.
To give them an opportunity to all talk through some of these things. And so I think that this is going to be something that fans love. And I mean, the most surprising thing to have happened, which I don't know why we're surprised, Jeffrey Combs shows up.
He is everywhere.
And Endorian fight scenes ensue. Fantastic. I think this is going to be a wonderful extra.
Right. Of course, Jeffrey Combs would have to surprise the cast. It's kind of the way John DeLancey surprised the Next Generation cast. I don't know if you've seen the entire video footage of this reunion that they had, but John DeLancey shows up and it was wonderful. And so same thing here with Jeffrey Combs. And I'm really looking forward to this. They got together last Wednesday, April 10th, entire principal cast. And as you said, Brandon Braga was there with them. There's a photo of the whole group together. They all still look great. And I've really loved on the Enterprise Season 1 Blu-rays the sit-down discussions with Braga and with Berman.
Yes.
And hearing that very candid process, and not just them, but you know, there's also a lot of interesting stuff on there with Dominic Keating and with Connor Trinneer and with Scott Bakula, and seeing them all together where they can really interact with one another instead of just one-on-one with an interviewer is going to be fantastic. And I imagine we're going to learn all sorts of fascinating information about the process of prepping for the show, making the show, how the cast got on with one another on the set. It's going to be exciting.
Well, and seeing this picture reminds me that honestly, this cast could get back into those uniforms and play those parts, and I wouldn't feel like it had been 10 years. They could definitely make them look like it. Maybe it had only been a couple of years. This cast still looks great. And, you know, so with all that talk about season 5, will it maybe come back on Netflix? What's going to happen? You know, I see this picture and I think, I could definitely see a season 5 on Netflix with these guys. This would be fantastic.
Yeah, they might be able to pull it off. Yeah, I agree. So we'll see. We don't have too long to wait for Enterprise Season 2 Blu-rays, and we can enjoy this reunion. So, Matthew, let's move on to our next story. And the cover for this was a little bit confusing at first because it's the TV Guide, and I saw this cover, and it had Kirk and Spock on it. It had 60 in big numbers on it. And at first, you're thinking, I know Star Trek's been around a long time, but, you know, it's not 60 years old. But, of course, what this is actually about is the 60th anniversary of TV Guide itself. And to celebrate, they've created 6 collectible commemorative covers. And they've chosen the most influential show from each decade for the 60 decades that TV Guide has been around.
Which I think is really, really cool that Star Trek gets this honor for the 60s being the most influential show. You know, with the 50s, they have here I Love Lucy. The 70s, you got the Mary Tyler Moore Show. 80s, you know, fan favorite, the Cosby Show was fantastic. The 90s, The Simpsons. I mean, there has been only... how many years of my life? I think there's 9 years of my life where the Simpsons hasn't existed.
Right.
I mean, so, and then for the 2000s, you have Lost. And so, but I love that Star Trek is getting this honor, that it really did revolutionize TV. And the bromance of Kirk and Spock definitely lives on.
Yeah, I have to agree with them that Star Trek has to be pegged as the most influential show that came out in the 60s. Now, I don't know that Star Trek was the most influential show during the 60s when it was airing at the end of that decade. But in terms of a show from the 60s that has had the greatest influence on American culture, for sure, and really has become an international phenomenon, would have to be Star Trek. And I think I agree to 1950s. I Love Lucy is a very good choice. And, but I really think that they fell down here with the 1980s. I mean, The Cosby Show was great. And of course, I also love Bill Cosby's Jell-O pudding pop commercials. But come on, everybody knows that the most influential show in the 1980s.
Give it to us.
Tell me, Matthew, what was it?
Bosom Buddies.
Bosom Buddies.
It had to be Bosom Buddies. Talk about a bromance that just went on, and just a fantastic show. Concept-wise, execution-wise, Tom Hanks in drag, it just doesn't get any better.
It really doesn't. It was the inspiration for the Deep Space Nine episode, Profit and Lace.
I know, exactly. And I don't understand either. The 90s, back in the 1900s, as we shall call them, where's Dawson's Creek? Why is it The Simpsons? Come on, everybody knows those Creek River kids, jumping in each other's rooms and beds. That was the most influential show on TV in the 90s. So, seriously, I think they got the 90s wrong, too.
The 90s had so many good shows. I mean, I would argue that Seinfeld should be the choice for the 90s. Because The Simpsons has the longevity, and definitely, I can't argue with them about The Simpsons. But Seinfeld, there is no show that brought everyone in America together every Friday morning to talk around the water cooler like Seinfeld did. And there are so many references now in popular culture that were born of Seinfeld.
Well, and I think the 90s is probably the hardest, because then you also have Friends too, and again, another show that,
yeah, there's so many shows,
still lives on in a way that most shows don't. I mean, Friends and its vernacular is just really part of our society now, and so in the same ways that something like Star Trek really gave us a whole new way of talking about things. So on a whole, though, this is a great list. I think they did a good job.
One other thing here, as you mentioned that, one thing that Star Trek did, and the reason that it's pegged as one of the most influential shows, is that it really challenges your mind, challenges you to think. It presents big ideas, and it helps you expand your knowledge of the world. Now, in the 2000s, there's another show that did that, that is surprisingly not on the list here, and that is Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Why is that not their choice for the 2000s?
You really have a great point there. I mean, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Definitely, expanded our horizons with our knowledge, made us realize that we are not smarter than a fifth grader. So, this is a good point. I think, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? I'm going to have to go think about that. I'll be back, Chris.
All right. So if you are in the States, you can pick up this copy of TV Guide on the newsstands. How much is TV Guide these days, Matthew? Does anyone still buy this publication?
I don't know. I think TV Guide's like $4 or $5 or something. And it's...
Wow. God, I remember when it used to be 69 cents. Seriously. 89 cents. Yeah. All right, but you can pick it up there, and I don't know if you can. I would imagine that some source, StarTrek.com or someone, probably have a way for people to order some copies of this, or you can go to TVGuide.com. I'm sure you can somehow order these commemorative issues from there.
Definitely.
All right. So, Matthew, what else do we have up to discuss today?
We had something really interesting. Dayton Ward was talking about his favorite Star Trek audiobooks, and author, friend of the network, Dayton Ward, picking out what he thought were the best Star Trek audiobooks. And as we know, they don't really do Star Trek audiobooks anymore unless it is the novelization of the film, which you and Colin talked about at length last week, that we all hope Alice Eve will be, at least Colin does apparently, and he thinks I do as well. We all hope that Alice Eve is going to be reading in her underwear. I don't think that any of the people reading these audiobooks was reading in their underwear, but who knows? William Shatner read Ashes of Eden, so he could have been in his boxers eating some fried chicken.
He could have been.
Reading Ashes of Eden. Yeah.
Like in the first one here, Strangers from the Sky, written by Margaret Wonder Bonanno, read by George Takei, with Leonard Nimoy as Spock in their underwear.
Oh my.
Now, we've seen Spock in his underwear in Star Trek 4.
And we have seen George Takei, you know, down to his skivvies. I mean, he naked now. He is just running around like crazy.
Indeed he was. So this was a nice article to see, because we've talked about audiobooks a little bit on Literary Treks and the fact that we would love to have some of these produced once again for some of the newer novels. I have very fond memories, especially in the 90s, of listening to many of these Star Trek audiobooks in my car as I had to run around town. And of course, I've also read a number of these books in their printed form as well. Dayton has listed his 10 favorites in order of publication. So going back to the oldest one, which I just mentioned, Strangers from the Sky, one of the great Star Trek books that tells the secret history of first contact between humans and Vulcans when Vulcans crash in the South Pacific. And this predates the events that were played out in First Contact, although I feel like this novel had a good bit of influence on First Contact, at least indirectly.
That's true. Of course, it does not predate the actual First Contact in Enterprise that, of course, T'Pol tells about Vulcans being in Carbon Creek. And so,
right.
Still, even though this is the secret history of the First Contact, we know there's an even more secret history, and that's with T'Pol. So I'm sorry, Margaret,
right.
But you're off.
Have you read this book?
You know, I haven't. It's one of those that I should go back and read. You know, there were some of those back in the day. Like, I haven't read, like, Spock Lives and Spock Dies, okay. And all, you know, there's a lot of those older books that I haven't gotten a chance to go back and read, and Strangers from the Sky is one of them.
There are a few of the older books that are must reads, which many of them are on Dayton's list here. I would say this is one of those that you definitely want to go back and read from the older novels.
The next book, though, Prime Directive, I have read at least, I think, 3 times, and it is a fantastic book. Judith and Garfield Reef Stevens are amazing authors. Obviously, they worked on Enterprise. I wish they had brought them in sooner because of their writing talents. And they are also well known for writing with William Shatner and his Shatnerverse, and really helping him along, I think. But they're on this list a few times because of that, and well deserved.
They have written some of my favorite Star Trek novels. It's a good point on Enterprise. I wish they had brought them in from the beginning of Enterprise. Because as much as I love a lot of the stories that we do get in seasons 1 and 2, I think with Judith and Garfield's influence on the storytelling, Enterprise would have had more of that TOS prequel flavor that fans were looking for, because
exactly.
They are fantastic writers. So Prime Directive, basically, Kirk takes the Enterprise, if I remember correctly, to warp in the atmosphere of a planet, destroys, it appears that he's responsible for the destruction of a civilization. And then the story goes on from there and how it plays out with the characters. Very, very good book. Really encourage everyone to read, or in this case, the audio version, listen to this one, which is read by James Doohan.
Perfect person to want to listen to as well. And of course, the next book on the list was Q and Law by Peter David, and it's read by Mijel Barrett, as well as John Delancey himself as Q. So always exciting when he is doing his character of Q. I can't imagine really anybody else reading that and really trying to pull that off.
Right. I could be wrong about this. I feel like all of the Q books that were turned into audiobooks were read by John Delancey. Could be wrong on that, but I feel like it has. I've listened to several of them. So that's a great book where the Enterprise is going to play host to a wedding that's designed to bring together rival factions of a Federation ally. And then Q shows up to put the moves on Lwaxana.
All the people to put the moves on. Lwaxana probably seems like the easiest person to put the moves on.
I think so, right? She's usually putting the moves on someone else, right?
She just kind of seems like she's pretty much ready to go, you know, for whoever is game, so...
Really, Picard, Odo, you never know.
Yeah, whoever's apparently around. Q here.
Okay, so talking about Judith and Garfield, the next book on Dayton's list from 1994 is Federation. And this is one of my all-time favorite Star Trek novels.
This was a great book. Doing the whole bringing Kirk and Picard together in a way that, you know, obviously Generations hadn't come out yet, and so this was the big book. I mean, you wanted to read to see what happened and how did Picard and Kirk meet, you know, and then this really fleshes out Zefram Cochrane before First Contact. And in fact, I remember that in this book that the Delta Shield comes from his explanation of how warp works and that he's drawing it for somebody, and it basically makes the Delta Shield that we know of that sits on, you know, Kirk's chest or becomes the Starfleet insignia. And so I just loved that they had done all those kind of things, and you know, it's just fan love right there. And they definitely understood, I think, what fans wanted, but gave it to them in a really good way.
I remember having this book in hardcover when it first came out, and I used to play bass trombone in an orchestra. That was I did that for a long time, and because I played bass trombone, I had a lot of times during rehearsals where I didn't play because, you know, it's strings play all the time. The low brass doesn't play all the time. So I still remember very, very well reading this novel during rehearsals over the course of a week when I'm not playing. I had a hardcover of Federation back there in the back and I'm reading. And when it was my time to play, I'll put my book down, pop my horn up, play my part, go back to reading.
Can you guys stop asking me to play right now? I'm at the best part. Kirk just met Picard.
I'm at a good part right now.
They just shook hands. Come on.
That's right. All right. So what's Dayton's next pick here?
The next one is Ashes of Eden. That's actually written by Shatner as well as Judith and Garfield as well, and read by William Shatner. So you get the fantastic cadence of Shatner reading the older Kirk in this book after Star Trek VI, but before Generations, and his adventures then and what he did then was... I really liked this book when it came out. I have no problems with the Shatnerverse. Give me the Return any day. I ate it up. I thought it was great. I thought that, just his series with Judith and Garfield, they would take all these ideas, and I felt like they just... weren't afraid to play in the sandbox of Star Trek and do something that was kind of outrageous. And I just enjoyed that because sometimes Star Trek films and the shows, they took things very safe. You know, they weren't afraid to shake things up. And that was enjoyable for me.
Yeah. The whole Shatnerverse series, it does kind of divide fans, right? There are some fans who love it, some fans who hate it, think it's sacrilege to Star Trek and Kirk, but there were 10 novels that make up the Shatnerverse, and this is the first one, and the first 9 of them are all available as audiobooks, and they're all read by William Shatner. And I mean, it doesn't matter what the story is. If William Shatner's reading it, it's pretty much worth listening to. I would actually love to have like all the classics, all the great classics in literature read by William Shatner. That's kind of what I want.
I can't imagine the classic, The Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Can we get that to happen, Chris? Hold on, I'm going to get Shatner on the phone right now. Or at least I'll tweet him.
I have a lot of audiobooks read by William Shatner, and he's just fantastic is all I can say about it. I don't get people who don't like William Shatner. I know that there are a lot of them out there, even a lot of Star Trek fans who just kind of don't like Shatner, but I don't know why. I think he's brilliant. He could read absolutely anything.
You dig the Shat. We understand.
All right, well, let's go on. Next one, Crossover by Michael Jan Friedman. This one's read by Jonathan Frakes.
Which was really weird. You know, I heard that in a recording studio the whole time he's reading standing up, leaning on something with his leg propped up on the chair. And they were like, Jonathan, don't you want to sit in the chair? And he's like, no, I'm fine. This is more comfortable. What's weird is that I think Kate was in the chair and his crotch was in her face. So
I like when there are those stories about the recording of Crossover where he's reading and he gets to part and he's not quite sure about the pronunciation of the names of some of the aliens in the story. And they had Michael Jan Friedman in there on hand, you know, in case there were questions like that, because you want it to be truly authentic to the author's vision. And Frakes would take the script, take the manuscript over to Michael and prop his leg up right by Michael's face and say, look, is this Iodian or Ilonia? I'm not sure. How do you pronounce this alien right here? And Michael's like, look, if you just back off a little bit, I'll let you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry, John, but the vibe, it's too much. It's too close, too close. Okay, that's better. There you go. Okay, that's great. Now, what was your question again? Because I couldn't hear you with that much vibe in my face.
Oh, so this is the story of Spock working in secret to reunite the Romulans and the Vulcans. And then he's captured, and the story plays out from there. And Scotty hijacks the Yorktown to go help. So, you know, anytime Scotty's hijacking a starship, you know, you've got a fun story.
It's true. It's true. I mean, yeah, that's just a classic move for Scotty.
The next one on the list is Inside Star Trek, The Real Story. And now this is a nonfiction book from 1996. This is written and read by Herbert F. Solow and Robert H. Gestman. And of course, everyone knows that they are two of the key figures in the development of Star Trek from the very beginning.
Yeah, this is an awesome book. I mean, one, just having that firsthand account of the development of Star Trek from the beginning, and then really getting it told by the two men who were a part of that development. And, you know, and then two, this being an audiobook actually read by them. So those parts that they're really excited about, you know, I wonder how they would mix that up and say, okay, I really want to read this part. And you can really read, you know, because I feel like there's probably parts of the story where they're very excited and they, you know, they really want to share. And to get to hear that in their own voice, you know, it would almost be like, I feel like sitting down and getting just to have a conversation with them and to listen to them
right.
Give you the answers back. So this is a fantastic audiobook.
Right. Yeah, this is one I actually have not listened to, so I'm going to have to go after the show and pick this up from Audible because I'm really curious to hear this particular one. I like all that behind-the-scenes discussion about the development of the shows and such. The next one on here is one that I have listened to. I do have it in my library. This is Spock versus Q, Armageddon Tonight.
Man, sounds like a really catchy tune, you know? I feel like Vic's going to sing to me about Spock versus Q. Armageddon tonight. Armageddon tonight. And then John Delancey would just come in, you know. Just a snappy tune. I want to hear this one. But, you know, I haven't... It's funny. I honestly haven't even heard of this book, and maybe that's just me. But again, you know, it's read by Leonard Nimoy and John Delancey, and apparently it's called The Intellectual Battle for the Ages, Spock versus Q.
The Spock versus Q stuff is fun because it's more like a little debate between Leonard Nimoy and John Delancey. It's not really a book, like in the sense of a novel where they're reading it. It's this kind of back and forth between Delancey and Nimoy. It's really good stuff. So I really do encourage everyone to pick up Spock versus Q if you haven't heard it yet, because, you know, two of the great voices in Star Trek for sure.
They don't sing. So you're saying they don't sing.
I don't think they sing. No, I'm sorry, but you know, they leave that up to you.
Yeah, well, everyone's turned off this podcast now, so.
Okay, so we have two more on here. And the next one, which is actually two, because it's volume one and two, this is something we just talked about on Literary Treks, which I'm still editing right now, that I'll release later today. The Eugenics Wars by Greg Cox. Now, Greg was just with us on Literary Treks a few days ago, and we talked about the Eugenics Wars.
Yeah, this is fantastic. These are great books, really giving us the background about Khan.
Right, yeah. And it involves a lot of other characters as well. It's like 20th century event, real world events, and how they play into the Star Trek timeline. And of course, there's fictional stuff in there as well.
Along with Gary Seven as well.
Right, Gary Seven as well. So very, very unique Star Trek books, I would say. Definitely something for fans of how history unfolds in the Star Trek timeline to read, as well as for fans of Khan, like you say. And the first volume is read by Anthony Stewart Head, and the second volume is read by none other than René Auberjonois, also known as Odo.
Perfect. And great voice too. I think he has a really good voice for reading as well.
He does. He does. I loved his voice on Benson. All right. And last one, and this is here because they are in chronological order of publication, is the novelization of the 2009 Star Trek movie by Alan Dean Foster, read by Zachary Quinto.
Which is great. I mean, you know, Zachary reading a book to you, I don't think it's going to be as impactful as Alice Eve's reading of Into Darkness, but we'll have to wait and see. But I do think she's probably going to upstage Quinto for the best Star Trek audiobook ever.
Probably so. Definitely with the behind-the-scenes photos that will come out.
It's going to start to sound like a Maxim cover shoot.
Matthew, let's take a break from news for a moment here and talk about our sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way for you to create a personal blog, a website, a portfolio, or even an online store with the new Squarespace Commerce feature. And, you know, one of the things I love about Squarespace so much is the fact that it's a system that you use entirely in your browser. It's hosting and it's CMS all in one for an incredibly low price. And you don't even have to worry about complex software like Dreamweaver. You don't have to worry about creating multiple versions of your artwork in Photoshop to put them on your website because you manage everything in your browser with images. It's a simple drag and drop interface. If you want to put an image on your page, you drag it into your browser window. Squarespace creates 7 different sizes of your image on the fly and then intelligently uses those within the framework of your site so that your image appears just the way you want it in any situation.
Well, one of the things that I really like as well is this. If you have a blog already somewhere else, Chris, you can import that content from, say, WordPress or Tumblr or Blogger or one of the other places and just seamlessly import that into Squarespace. And, you know, instead of having to go and rebuild everything, which is so frustrating, you know, and it definitely keeps you from wanting to kind of move your blog or your website somewhere else. Squarespace has just made that as simple as possible.
Absolutely, definitely. Yeah, and it's great because when you sign up, you get access to all the tools free for 14 days. You don't even need to give them a credit card. And when you import it, as you're saying, Matthew, you can see exactly what the site's going to look like in there. And then you could use the tools to tweak it and create your own look and feel based on some of the amazing professionally designed templates. And you can do all this while your site is still there on the other platform. So there's no disruption. And it makes it so, so easy for you to take all the work that you've done in the past on your site and just bring it right on over. Matthew, today we want to talk about three items that we haven't talked about before on here. One of them is a new feature, and then there are two new templates. And the new feature that we want to tell everyone about is the calendars feature. And, you know, this is great for if you're a writer, for example. Maybe you write short stories, maybe you write novels, maybe just write, you know, for fun. I used to do this for a long time. I wrote a column called Science Fiction and Society many, many years ago. And I actually had a calendar on there because I had planned out my article schedule and I wanted people to know when I'm going to release things. And with the calendar feature, you can actually create either a list view or a calendar view. And the great thing about this is you don't have to worry about creating a table, for example, as you know I would have done in the past with a tool like Dreamweaver. You just pull down the calendar block, you put it on your page, you fill in the information, and Squarespace does all the rest for you.
And I think one of the other cool things, Chris, with this calendar is that you can add events to your website by clicking the Add a Page to your website manager. You can select the events. You can also add each event that you would like on your blog entry by adding additional information with your dates, URLs. You can put images, thumbnail images in there, even products from your store if you're using the commerce feature, which is so nice here on Squarespace. And then you can easily push that event information to social media channels. And you can also share the events on things like Google Calendar or iCal, which is so important these days with so many people using these online calendar features. And so just really making it simple to be able to take your calendar on your Squarespace site and make it functional with everything else in your life.
Most definitely. Yeah, it's great having that integration between your site and those calendar tools like Google Calendar or iCal. Most definitely. Another thing that is new that just launched this month is a new template design called Adirondack that is perfect for an online store. So again, if you're going to look into the commerce feature, if you want to sell, if you're a business and you have items to sell, or if you're just an individual and you make crafts or you write, you know, you want to sell any of your own products there, Adirondack is a great option. It's a very clean site, minimal navigation. It has great full header images, and it's just a very bold framework for your company or your brand. It has a really cool effect with the very large image as you load the page, and as you scroll down, and it fades away and it reveals the rest of the page. I really love this fade out effect. It looks so professional, and it's built into the template, so you don't need to figure out how to do this yourself. You just go there and use this, and then you can make adjustments to the template as well. It's got pre-built pages for your contact information, for your catalog, for your shipping information. Very, very easy to use. Now, if you don't want to build a store, maybe you want to share your photography, maybe you want to share more of your creative work, or you just want to have a personal blog, there's also a new template called Momentum. And I like Momentum so much that I just recently changed the design of my personal website from what I was using before to Momentum.
What I like about the Momentum, Chris, is that it's a really flexible design built specifically for photographers and designers in mind who really want to showcase their work. And I know that you, as a designer, this is really important. You want this template to really showcase your portfolio, giving you that cinematic feel, full bleed image display, or even preserving the original resolution and visual integrity of an image so you can get that center display. It gives it that that feel that you've spent hours when really Squarespace has done all the work for you.
Definitely. Yeah, this is important for me because I have so many different types of work and all that I want to display. And so this multi-index feature is another reason why I have chosen to switch my personal site over to Momentum. So we'd like to invite you to try Adirondack, Momentum, the calendar feature, the commerce feature, all the great features of Squarespace free for 14 days. Squarespace has a special offer for Trek FM listeners. If you use the offer code TREK4, you'll get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And if you choose the annual option, Squarespace will actually register a custom domain for you for free. It's included as part of the package. It's very easy to get that set up. So you can go there, Matthew. You can get MatthewRushing.com very easily. Just in a matter of minutes, you're up and running. It's really fantastic. Now, the pricing is extremely affordable. It's $8 for the basic package, which has most of the things that, you know, the average person would need for a personal site, for sure. For $16, you have the unlimited package, and for $24, the business package, which includes everything in unlimited, plus the amazing commerce features. And the way you try this out is you just go to squarespace.com/trek, and you enter the offer code TREK4 when you sign up, and you'll get 10% off. And you'll be supporting our sponsor, and you'll be helping us bring this programming to you every week. All right, Matthew, let's move into movie news and rumors. And of course, there are fewer rumors these days and just more news. And today we've got actually a lot of stories about marketing and artwork, pretty much. And a number of posters have come out over the past week. And the first one that I wanted to talk about is the most unique one, and that is the Cinemosaic poster for Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, this is a pretty neat idea. Something that I think you had mentioned, I don't know if it was on the other side of the room or
the other side of the room
when, but just the idea that this is very Tumblr like in its look. They are separate GIFs, three in a row and three rows, that make up a full poster that then flash. And they'll get to the point where they show the entire Into Darkness poster that we've seen before. But, you know, each one then goes into another routine and then comes back. And it's pretty cool. I like it a lot. You know, I'm for those movie theaters, I don't know if you have this in Japan, but we have some movie theaters here that use very large LED screens as movie posters. Instead of just, you know, having a movie poster in a backlit shadow box, now they'll just use an LED screen. And so this is something that would really work well, I think, on a screen like that, having this kind of motion poster. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it being used in that way, but that would be pretty cool. Yeah, it's I find this poster interesting primarily as a marketer, and the fact that Bad Robot, J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot, are very tuned into marketing, and they have been for a long time. You see a lot of it in Lost, the way that they used supplemental web material with the TV show, for example. They really are masterful at the way that they market their products. And this is, yeah, as soon as I saw it, I was completely thinking Tumblr. You know, there's some members of our Trek FM family here. Tristan, international sex symbol and co-host of To the Journey.
To the Journey!
Okay, To the Journey. My exo, Tanya, are two examples, people who are really into Tumblr. And they're often reblogging on Tumblr, which comes out on Twitter. These types of animated GIFs and tiled Cinemosaic type items, usually created by fans. This is a case where it's actually being created by the studio as an official marketing piece, and I find it interesting. It kind of symbols how they're in tune with the way the audience is interacting with the material these days. And it's nice. I like the big printed posters better personally, visually. But Star Trek should be using technology to its advantage, and that's, you know, what they're doing here.
Yeah, definitely doing, I think, a good job of being clued in to how people are consuming media these days, and understanding the you know, mass appeal of something like Tumblr and how it can just spread like wildfire, and then just creating something for that to then spread is perfect. You know, honestly, I think the goal here is, well, if we create something, put it out there, we don't even have to do the work. The fans will do the work for us.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're into that. Additional posters that have come out. And again, this is another marketing thing, because these posters are coming out exclusively through the iTunes movie trailers site. And they are apparently releasing a new poster each day. They've released three of them so far. One of them came out just before we went on the air. And I believe the fourth one, which from what we've seen of a tiled image, is probably going to be John Harrison, will probably come out tomorrow together with a new trailer that is going to be released on April 16th. Now, Matthew, why don't you describe these posters for us?
Well, the first poster you have is a beautiful poster of Uhura in action. It's that scene that we've seen in the trailer where she's on Kronos. She's looking one way, her gun is pointed the other, and you can tell that she's very much in action of probably swinging that disruptor around, probably looking at some awesome fight scene going on, probably some Andorians.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
Even though she's on Kronos, you know how the Andorians, they're willing to be in any kind of fight. And then... You know, but that's it's a beautiful shot. It's well done, well edited. It definitely just comes straight from the film. So this isn't something I feel like they had to work really hard on.
You know, to me, it looks like she's preparing to do a barrel roll.
Oh, man. Yes, that's it. Chris, you've nailed it. Excellent. She's probably going to have to do that so that she can miss the disruptor blast that's coming towards her. And as we all know, if you are in a sci-fi movie, human beings can always move faster if they're paying attention to those kind of blasts. So this is
absolutely
perfect. Yeah. the next one, honestly, Chris, is I think my favorite poster that they've done for the film so far. And that is not to say that this poster is actually that great. But it's the picture of the Enterprise screaming towards Earth, flaming. And it's a beautiful shot. And it's the only one here, I feel like, that really resonates with Star Trek. Like, it's the only one that, you know, I automatically know this is Star Trek. Because it's the Enterprise, and it's in trouble. And it's a, you know, for me too, if the Enterprise is destroyed if in the service of the story, I'll be really excited. I think that's great. You know, anytime you sacrifice a ship, you know that the stakes are really high. You know, same way you had that in Star Trek 3. And so I really actually like this poster. If you know, if there was going to be a poster out of any of these that I might buy, it would be this one, unless they come out with another one that's even better.
Yeah, I agree. This is the one that does let you know that it is a Star Trek movie. And like you say, if they destroy the Enterprise in the service of the story, I would be perfectly fine with that. I mean, I'm one of those fans who personally doesn't like the JJ Enterprise very much. I think it's very awkwardly designed. It does not balance very well. And I wouldn't mind... I don't know, you know, they've heard that from so many fans. I do kind of wonder if they are going to destroy the ship in this movie so that they can have a new ship in the next movie, the way that they destroyed the Enterprise D in Generations, so that they could then build a new ship that would look better on the big screen.
Yeah, that apparently, or, you know, Troy's, you know, predecessor is apparently gotten a hold of the Enterprise here. And, well, we all know what happens.
Is this going to be like when Sulu's daughter was the helmsman of the Enterprise B? Is one of Troy's ancestors going to be
taking the helm in this movie, taking over from Sulu temporarily and crash the ship.
Yeah, you know, Sulu had to run to the head, and he was going to be right back. He told her not to touch anything, and she just could not stop from touching the flashing green light. So the next poster is actually really cool. It is Spock standing at the bottom of the volcano with all of the fire kind of coming around him, and it's a beautiful shot. It looks like a billion volcanic fireflies are flying around him in this poster shot. It's really nice work. Again, though, it's not poster work to me. You know, taking a still from the movie and slapping your name over it is, and you know, probably doing a little bit of Photoshop editing. This is not poster work. You know, at least I feel like the shot with the Enterprise screaming towards it looks a little bit more like it's had some artwork done to it. I mean, it could, again, just be a straight shot from the movie. I don't know. But, you know, stills from a movie with your name plastered over them, I can do that. I'm not impressed. You know, give me an artist creating an actual poster.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I feel like the ones here of Spock and Uhura are, because they don't have the entire credits at the bottom like the Enterprise one does, I feel like that those are part of a series. There's this other one here that you found that has four posters. It has Uhura and Spock, which we've already seen. It also has Kirk running through the red cornfield. And then it has Harrison apparently in the midst of an explosion. Because it looks like the city behind him there. And the four of those together, and then it has Star Trek Into Darkness in the center. And these are meant to make that single image, kind of like you might have four different magazine covers that come together. I don't think they're really meant to be standalone movie posters per se, like you would see hanging in the theater.
Yeah, it definitely looks like they've created, you know, those huge banners that you get in a movie theater when you go and...
Well, yeah, we have that here, like Warner Michael Theater here will have the entrance outside on the side of the building, absolutely enormous banner space. And like when The Hobbit was out, they had a very, very, very nice one. Excellent. On the exterior of the building. This looks like something that you would throw up there on the side.
Man, don't get me started on The Hobbit, Chris. You know that I could start talking about The Hobbit for a very long time, so we should probably not go there.
I'm going on an adventure!
Okay, but we'll put links to all of these so that you can see them if you want to. iTunes movie trailer site has each individual poster, and you can actually download them. They're like 6 or 7 megabyte files. So you, if you wanted to, if you have a large format printer, you could actually print these out rather large and stick them on your wall if you want. And then there is supposed to be a new exclusive trailer coming out through iTunes on Tuesday, same day as the show drops. So keep your eyes open for that as well. Matthew, last item that we'll talk about in news today, Benedict Cannonbatch, as we used to call him on here, and we're still wondering if he is a canon character or not, was talking to The Hindu in India, and he talked a little bit about some of Harrison's motives.
Yeah, this is a good interview. It definitely, I think, he's getting less and less... nuanced in his hints that he drops. There's some things in here that really I think lend to seeing him as a character that we may have seen before in canon, but at the same time, you know, we could just be wrong. But looks like that he is going to be someone who is a terrorist, but he says it's not your usual type of villain. It's really somebody who's very calculating, intelligent, and has a reason for all of his actions. But he also says he's a really ferocious warrior. And as we've seen in these trailers and in these TV spots, I mean, he's going up against Spock in hand-to-hand combat. And we all know that Vulcans have superior strength and agility. So to be able to take on Spock hand-to-hand combat-wise, you're going to have to be very strong. And very interested to see this.
Right. And of course, a lot of the movie takes place on Kronos, so he could end up fighting Klingons, which, you know, may also require greater strength than fighting Kirk would.
Exactly.
But yeah, he says that there's a political ideology that he is fighting for. And this, I think, kind of plays into what you and I have talked about here in Literary Treks a good bit as we've read through the comics, that there does seem to be some sort of division within Starfleet. There seems to be something seedy going on within Starfleet. And there is a battle for ideology of what Starfleet should be and what the Federation should be.
Well, and especially then the comics that have just preceded this, you know, all this talk about the Prime Directive and everything into that, especially with Robert April and, you know, Admiral Marcus, all of these things are really playing into, I think, that there is going to be a huge discussion in this film philosophically about what Starfleet is standing for and what it's been up to. Because it really does seem like that there's been some things that Starfleet may be involved in that they probably shouldn't be. And
right.
So you could be you could understand why somebody like this person, Harrison, could really have an axe to grind then philosophically with the Federation.
Exactly. So, and again, we still don't know, which is amazing because we're only a month away from release now, and we still really don't know for sure.
It definitely helps us understand, too, how he could want to detonate Starfleet and all that it stands for.
Oh, you know, the person who wrote that press release is never going to live that down, are they?
They probably just want to detonate that press release and all that it stands for.
Oh, so again, he was consuming 4,000 calories a day for about a month and a half to build up his physique. And besides the fighting that we just talked about, the Hindu also asked him why. And he said that I can't say why at this point, but it was for a scene where my physicality is revealed at one point, but it might get cut. So yeah, now why would, what character from Star Trek history do you think might make them want to reveal Cumberbatch's physique?
Well, two things. One, Kirk always gets to take his shirt off. So,
but we know he's not playing Kirk, so that's
Cumberbatch
out.
Could just want to be able to, you know, best Kirk in a shirt off.
Oh, they're gonna have a shirt off.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why you don't want to talk about it. You know, whose barrel chest is better. You know,
that's what's going on in that scene where Scotty is hugging Uhura and Uhura really worried.
Yeah.
Opposite them, what they're looking at, they're watching Chris Pine and Benedict Cumberbatch having a shirt off.
Yeah. Chest off between men. It's crazy. we've already seen that Alice Eve gets into her skivvies. Perhaps Benedict Cumberbatch's character gets into his and, I don't know. His physicality is revealed. I don't know what that means, but it could be the first R-rated Star Trek film.
These are great ideas. I was thinking of something much simpler, like showing off Khan's chest. To mark the 30th anniversary of Star Trek in 1996, the creative teams of both Deep Space Nine and Voyager were charged with the task of finding a way to pay homage to the original series and the original crew. And the Deep Space Nine team came up with what I feel is truly a Valentine to Star Trek in the episode Trials and Tribulations. And it was an amazing bit of work that they did. And today we're going to talk about Trials and Tribulations. And to help us do that, we have with us our managing editor, Mistress Charlene Schmidt. Hello, Char.
Hello, hello.
And we also have with us Dr. Trek himself, friend of the show, Larry Nemechek. Hello, Larry.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me on today. Yes, yes.
No, I'm kidding.
I wasn't sure who was going to show up. You know,
Pull yourself together, man.
The Dr. Trek thing just kind of threw me. I just wanted to be in the like Data in the future of all good things. I just wanted to be in the library, you know, with the big dots or Watson Pipe or whatever. So right. Anyway, yes, it's great. This is going to be a fun show. Yes.
I wasn't sure if Dr. Trek was going to show up or Dr. McCoy was going to show up, Larry. With you.
No, Dr. Trek's definitely Dr. Trek. Dr. McCoy needs to go, you know, eat his Cheerios or something, but it's Dr. Trek tonight.
I don't think Larry's had enough mint juleps yet for that.
Yeah, Larry, now on Star Trek Continues, did you get to drink a mint julep yet?
No, and I want to know what's going on with that, because we were in Georgia. Something's, you know, I'll put that on my list of demands for next time.
You should.
You should have had a Georgia-style mint julep if you were.
I didn't have a list of demands, so, you know, I do.
That's where you went wrong.
That's where I went wrong.
Yeah. You can't be a real actor if you don't want just, like, the blue M&Ms without any others.
I mean. Blue to match the shirt.
All right.
Yeah, well, we were just lucky, like, to get over going in the morning, so. Anyway.
Well, let's jump into Trials and Tribulations. This is, for me, it's a fun episode. Of course, it's probably the most fun you'll have on Deep Space Nine, just pure fun. This was right after Forrest Gump was out. I think we all remember seeing Forrest Gump in the theater, and then finding out that they're going to use the same technique to put the Deep Space Nine crew into an original series episode, but at the same time, do it in a way that it is a Deep Space Nine episode. It's like a script within a script, and it's an amazing bit of work that they did here. So, Larry, why don't you give us the background? How did this episode come to be in the first place?
Well, you're right. This was 96, and it was the 30th anniversary, and both shows wanted to do what they thought was a cool show. And I think what the reason everybody remembers Trials and Tribulations, and Flashback was cool too, and you had Sulu and Excalibur and all. I mean, the Excalibur.
Excalibur.
Where'd that come from?
That was the version that Peter David wrote. David's Flashback.
Okay, we just need to say right now that I just, on top of everything else in life, I just got through my son's weddings this weekend. So if I'm slipping a few gears here, I kept thinking about how I wasn't in charge of anything, but I was still exhausted after it was over. So,
well, congratulations to him.
Yes, congratulations.
Thanks.
Mazel tov.
So it's kind of interesting. I think the reason we all love this show so much, and not that we don't Flashback, but that we don't just, you know, it's not as rosy a glow, is I think it shows that when the writing pool of Next Generation, you know, drifted off to either show at the time, DS9 got all the old original series fans, and Voyager not so much, because Ron and Renee went over to join Ira and Hans Beimler and Robert Wolf over on DS9. And that was a toxic brew of original series, you know, funness and from the heartness. And so, I did an article way back in the day for the Communicator before I was editor about this. And I've said ever since then it was my most fun thing to do because it just kind of wrote itself. I spent a couple of days on the set and then did some, you know, pre and post interviewing and just kind of wrote it as a log. And it was just incredible to be there for two of the three or four days they were shooting, and to get all the backstory and the fact that they wanted to sit around and kicked around ideas. You said, so what did they come up with this? And they, you know, they wanted something lighthearted because they didn't think having a dramatic theme would work, and they wanted to kind of revisit something. And at the same time, they were thinking about story concepts. you mentioned Forrest Gump. At the same time, their heads were just they were just starting to explode with what was being possible with the revolution in CGI and all that. Now, DS9 was like the big holdout on doing CGI because Babylon 5 had done it and Voyager had kind of picked up the way. And Gary Hutzel was just very big on everything still looks CGI-ish on a TV time and budget. So, yeah. So they were thinking, you know, the idea of doing this originally, everybody was like, we can't do that. It'll look crappy. And even if we could afford it, you know, we don't have the time to do it. And the whole thing, there's a very famous test footage of they were goofing around and slid to, you know, two guys, and I can't remember their names, two guys at the effects house threw on a couple of original series makeshift shirts and just jumped into a scene that they pulled out from original series. And it was amazing. And Gary Hutzel went around and he came down to the Hart building and goes, guys, look at this. And it was like, you know, VHS tape, throwing it in the tape player, and everybody fell over. And they're like, yeah, but how long did you spend on this? No, we did this for like 5 cents. And they're like, really? And that was what really kind of exploded everyone's brains. And they thought, what can we do? What can we do? And as we kind of said, they were looking at they thought, well, okay, let's do a lighthearted show because we can't handle drama. And what can we tweak? And, you know, what? And they thought about doing, I think Ron thought about doing a return to, I mean, before they got into the Gump-like stuff, they talked about doing piece of the action, Return to Iosha, and coming in like 100 years after, you know, Kirk's time and watching and landing. And instead of gangsters, they're all running around like little Star Trek fans in original series shirts, you know. And they thought, well, that might be a little too far. But then the tape showed up and they went, oh, let's do it. But things gravitated over to doing Trials and Tribulations of the lighthearted shows. And then there's a sidebar story where they're all talking about this, and there was a pizza place that the writers would all go to for lunch together because Ira was big into keeping them together like that. And they were talking about a show, and the son of Charlie Brill comes over and says, you guys are talking about my – because they're going, yeah, but could we get blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And Charlie Brill? Who knows if he's still alive? I mean, they're all just kind of like – talking the way writers would talk at a show, having their lunch somewhere in around Hollywood. And Charlie Brill's son actually walked over, interrupted their conversation, and said, you talking about my dad? He would love to do this. And they were like, and I was like, it's a sign from God. We have to do this.
Right.
So
what
all of
odds?
Those things were a great little mix together. And, you know, so there you go. That was the roots of Trials and Tribulations.
It's amazing.
That is a cool story.
Shar and Matthew, the first time you saw Trials and Tribulations, what were your feelings on what they had put together?
I was blown away. I loved the effects where we have our Deep Space Nine crew looking just like they're absolutely a part of the original Enterprise, walking alongside Captain Kirk or Scotty or Chekhov. I thought that was incredible. And of course, the story is absolutely fantastic. I thought it was the perfect homage to Star Trek, the original series, for its 30th anniversary. I absolutely loved it. And like you said, Larry, no offense to Flashback, but this really nails it.
Yeah, I think there were two scenes that sold the episode for me. And honestly, it was when the view screen clears and you see the remade Enterprise that they've spent a lot of time rebuilding, and then they've been rebuilt K-7 as well. But that Enterprise looks fantastic.
It does.
You know, I mean, that's the best you'd ever seen the original series Enterprise look. And then of course the next scene that really sells it for me is, well, the moment Terry Farrell walks out in that uniform and you just kind of fall over and think, you know, with Bashir, yeah. God, I'm going to love
she
this
says,
time.
And women wore less.
Exactly. And this is when you just knew that this was going to be so much fun, that the writers had put everything into this and they were enjoying it just as much as we are. And in fact, the whole episode almost feels like a wink to the
right.
fans.
Totally.
You know, like, we're doing this because we love you. We love this show and we know how silly it can be. And we're just going to have the best time with you. And I think that's kind of what Flashback was actually missing, was that wink of, we're doing this because we love the show. This one just grabs you right away. The effects are fantastic. But I mean, you know, it's really just all to me about every time I watch this show, I'm blown away by how much fun the DS9 cast is having.
Totally.
They are in a whole nother level of fun in this episode. I mean, the way they're making fun of each other, the way they're getting along with each other in this episode is just fan-freaking-tastic.
Miles and Jules are completely on top of their game. Their bromance in this room.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Definitely.
When they are making fun of how Worf smells, awesome. You know, when Julian delivers the line of, and a hint of lilac.
Right.
It's, I mean, you almost fall out of your chair laughing, and then, of course, on the bridge, when O'Brien is talking to Dax, and he's like, the next time you see Worf, just kind of sniff the air around him and ask, is that lilac? I mean, this is great writing.
Absolutely.
You could just tell they know these characters, and they're just having a good time delivering these
right.
lines.
And I love Dax's follow-up to that line, which was, no, I have my own ways of torturing Worf, thanks.
Yeah.
Right.
That was awesome.
It's good. This is one of those times, a lot of these years are like this for me, where I can't, I mean, most of the shows are fine. It's like it's torture. But this is a show where I'm hopelessly bound up in having been close to watching it be filmed and watching the stories. It's a lot like the movies are when I would do a whole chapter just on a movie. And the freshness of sitting down, I don't say the episode is ruined, but the freshness of it. And now not so much this, because it was a one-time aired, and I don't think you could ever get tired of this show. Oh, there's a couple of – I think the weakest parts of the thing are when they're on the station. The ending, I think, is – I know Armin didn't like the ending where with the tribble on his head. He thought that was kind of – whatever. He's like – I mean, the realist in Armin playing Quark would say, because the camera cranes in and the tribble's on his head, it's like a joke, and the camera comes in slowly, and then he finally takes it off his head like he's so out of it that he didn't realize there was a tribble on his head for minutes and minutes and minutes until just then. I think he was not real happy that was like Quark's kind of big scene.
I like the fact that behind Quark right there, Morn is holding three tribbles.
Yes.
But it's wild, because it's you guys, what made me think of this was you guys were talking about how obvious it is that the cast enjoyed playing this, and I, as you said that, it made me think that yeah, it's kind of the same atmosphere when you're in a show that's there. They were always on stages, and they never got, they're not like a cop show where they'd be out on location around LA somewhere all the time, and whenever they'd go on location, like, you know, Take Me Out the Holosuite, or especially DS9, because they were always so dark and dreary anyway. But when they got to go on location, it was, you know, it was like vacation. It was like days off, only we're playing and getting paid for it. And this was the closest thing to being a long location vacation show, you know, because they're all wearing crazy outfits and doing. And if they were, they were a fan or they weren't a fan, you know, like Mike Dorn was a fan, and some of them were and some of them weren't, but they all knew. But they're all wearing the wacky pajama costumes, you know. But can you tell beyond the cast that I want to say every single other person in the whole damn crew was giving it their all and giving it their best. And you mentioned that article I wrote, which is at my site if anybody wants to go find it. It's on there. But they all were. And people were like going out of their way to get the nth degree. And they were like, we're trying to find the orange grid to put in the set wall. We can't find it. We have a fake. And then, oh my God, we're out walking down a construction site and somebody trips over it. And they go, here it is. And they go like run down the foreman of like, where did you get this stuff? And he's like, from the place we get our stuff. You know, I mean, and Mike trying to find the shower curtain plastic, you know, for the arches and for the wall panels in the turbo lift. And they finally give up and they like try to fabricate it on paper. And then, you know, a month or two later, they find it and they're like, oh, I wish we had this for the show. But I mean, there's so many million stories like that. And they're trying to find the K7 bar chairs, and they finally, some fan has one, and they make molds off that chair. And, you know, they're looking for like 30-year-old manufacturers from 60s stuff. And but everybody did that. I mean, all the fanboys in the art department, visual effects, you'd expect that. But everybody was doing it. And what's cool about this now in hindsight also, because at the time we were all blown away because you'd be on set, they had a big monitor, you know, watching the tape, because they were having to match lighting, especially like the bar fight scene, right? Okay, or anything that was supposed to match. they were not only matching the set and all that, but they were trying to match the lighting and the intensity of the light and all that, and Jerry Finnerman's, you know, splash the color on the wall thing and effects thing. And they realized that they couldn't match it to one of the old faded, because back then you had, you could buy a VHS tape, but it was the faded out one that all the TV shows were kind of. Now we're so spoiled on, Jesus Christ, DVDs, and now the Blu-rays, that we don't have Blu-ray for DS9. But that path that it's going, what they've done, the original series and Next Generation, and everybody's, the bar is so high, that didn't exist in 96, but they had to have the highest thing. They actually went and got the original negative out and made a print and put it on tape, and they were showing it. And half of what you did, it was enough to walk on the sets and be blown away by the set. And then, like, the second or third or 19th thing that was blowing you away when you were actually on the set visiting was you'd walk over to the monitor and they would show the scene they were matching to. And just, it was like you're watching this tape, but you're blown away because no one has seen the show look like that since 1967. I mean, the show, Star Trek of anything. Because we'd had 30 years of watching washed out syndication broadcasts and washed out videotapes.
Which had gotten
Paramount wasn't at the thing of spending bucks to do that. And that was the first time anybody had seen the stuff cleaned up and brightened and all that in ages. And we were just like, oh my God. Oh my, this is gorgeous. This could be shown right now. And that's when people and they did that, and you saw that on the show. And that was the first time somebody went, maybe next time we do a generational thing, we should go back and do new positives of, you know. And that, I mean, these are all just things that are, I'll shut up now, but these are all, talking about this show, it's hard for me to separate just talking about the show itself from the memories of watching it be shot and having something, and having these weird tangents like that, like people being blown away by the intensity of the color and thinking, oh my God, this is what it was like to watch it when it was on the first time. And now things we take for granted because we, you know, we have these newer cleaned up versions and whatever, but just what a revelation that was. And look how gorgeous, you know, this was, and look how they did it. Anyway, that's what some of these things bring to mind. But you talking about how the cast was obvious, they have 150 people on payroll, say. They were all bringing it for this show.
I think you can tell.
And you can tell it feels like just the kind of vibe patients just through the building, just it's crazy. You can tell that everybody is just in love with this idea, and they're giving 100 billion% to what they're doing, and it really shows on screen. And you were talking about the lighting, Larry, and on the other side of the room you'd mentioned your article, and then we mentioned it here, and I love that because I was reading it today, and so when I watched the episode I was watching for the lighting. And I was just noticing that there's those shots, especially in the bar, where Odo's sitting there, and then they'll pan over to Worf, and he's sitting there, and they're in the same type of lighting that you'll see then Scotty be in when he's up close. And it looks almost identical, as close as they can get it. And it feels like you're watching that old TOS episode. And then, of course, they bookend it with being on, you know, the station, and the lighting is back to being normal. But, you know, you get into that TOS world and you move into that lighting almost as if you were to, if it had been in black and white, we would have gone into black and white, like the Wizard of Oz or something. And it's just a beautiful of how they did this episode.
The contrast is so great too. When you go back to DS9, you have such, it almost feels muted compared to the vivacious colors of the original series. There's so much of a splash. Yeah, not only is the accuracy, the attention to detail amazing, and it does blow my mind too. I just kind of marveled in how accurate they really got it. But it's just beautiful. The look and the feel, along with all this energy that was put into this episode, man, you really do, just as a fan, feel all of it.
Yeah. And Larry, you talk about them finding the correct legs for the tables in the bar in K7 and the light fixtures and the hairstyles. And I think about the scene, a couple of scenes where Bashir and O'Brien are in the corridor and Bashir is scanning with his medical tricorder, and you can see the spinning bit inside the handheld piece. And when Sisko is on the bridge later and you see the screens and all the little colorful gems on the control panel, and you know, it would have been so easy for them to kind of half-ass things, you know, kind of like, well, we can't find exactly the right thing, so we're going to get it as close as we can and no one will notice. But instead, like you're describing, they go to such painstaking lengths to make sure that everything is completely accurate. And even if it looks cheesy, leave it that way, because that's how it was done originally. And I think that only true fans would care and actually go beyond the normal amount of work that they would need to do to make sure that all of that was 100% true to the original.
Well, there were, right. This is really scary. Okay, podcast listening world, you won't get this, but I just remembered that when the show was over up in the art department, they had cast all the, you're talking about the jelly bean buttons, you know, and everything for the original series. Now this, forget In a Mirror Darkly. That was, what, 05? That was another 9 years later. And every time they would do an original series bridge, starting with the little bit they did for Relics with Scotty on Next Gen, and then it would get bigger. I mean, Mike would always talk about how every time they redid the classic bridge, it would get better and better and more refined, and they built it for some of the tour shows and all that. But I just realized, this is what happens when you lived in the same house for too long. Can you? Nobody on the podcast can see that, but can you guys see this?
Yes.
Okay. This is, hold on a minute. This is, I just realized I brought home some of the things, some of the jelly beans from that week. Extras.
Oh, wow.
And he's been sitting in my drawer since 96.
Oh my God. That's,
I just
too
realized
cool.
That. That's too funny. But yeah, but see, I mean, there was a practical thing. One hand, if they were going to match footage, they had to have it look right. So on one hand, they couldn't have a crappy, sloppy looking show. But on the other hand, yeah, there's nth degrees of, there's a spectrum of having it match. And they, it was like professional pride, and they were honoring their own, and they were honoring, you know, the ones that went before. And it was just a hoot. And there was a little bit of a cross-series rivalry, because Voyager had been able to pull out almost all of the Excelsior bridge sections, original ones. And they were real thrilled about that, and bringing the panels out and having George and Grace Lee, you know, do that, and having a story merged in that they did on Voyager. But once they had that tape and had the guys that were Forrest Gumped in, and they just took off and ran with it. And you know, so many people, you know, and then on another front, Greg Jean, you're talking about, Matt, you're talking about the Enterprise model and the K-7 and the D-7 Klingon, which, you know, wasn't, you know, now
fantastic.
It's now, since Mike and Denise and Dave Rossi oversaw production CBS, and they did the remasters and the Blu-rays, and they dropped some of that stuff in CGI-wise. But, you know, the original Tribbles, we didn't see a Klingon ship orbiting. You know, they that was all part of the, we have no budget for it. They didn't have a model till the next year, so... it was, if you know, they might be a blob or something in, on the far scanner range or something. But Greg Jean and built, and this was pre-CGI, and they weren't about to try to do CGIs for this, but they built, he took the original, the 14-footer plans, or the 11-footer plans, 14-foot, and made a half-size one. So he made a 7-foot-long Enterprise model. And I've got pictures, if they haven't been published somewhere, and they made a rotating gizmo where the warp nacelles, where the Bussard collectors would actually rotate and have the light effect without them having to post it in. And it's little mirrors and spinning bits. And they built the K-7, and they built the and I took a ton of pictures of all this stuff for this article that was in Communicator. And then the guy, Dan, and the guys like lost them temporarily. I was like, no, I took all these pictures. So I've used them since then, but it was great. They did one of the guys that was working with Greg on K-7. I think this has since been published, did a little bitty detail, because we never saw Cyrano Jones's, you know, ship. So just for fun, in the pre-CGI, let's do it for fun days that way, they did a little inset. They built a little docking bay at that flat round disc at the bottom of K-7. Did you see
it? I saw it.
The super detailed thing where they had the shuttle and
awesome.
And they made a little design of a little generic Cyrano Jones thing, and it's called it's the Spacematic is the name of his little thing. But there's a little banner on the back end of, and a little Galileo type Class F shuttlecraft lettered for DSS or DSS K-7. And on the back wall, there's a thing that says, "Welcome to K-7, now go home." But it's like, you know, on a whole little miniature that's like, you know, 2 inches by 3 inches that's stuck in this thing, and wow. You don't know it unless you're down looking at the model. It's not going to film at all. But anyway, that's the little fun little inside stuff. Here's these guys doing it, but they're all doing it like for like practically nothing. They're putting all this time and effort, again, into building 1, 2, and 3, and I'm sure they didn't sit down and budget 3 original miniatures, you know, including the Klingon D7. But again, it's more a case of how much was just drippingly fanish love, nerdgasm put into this show and people going above and beyond. And I don't think any of those 3 models were ever used again. I mean, for a filmed thing. I think they went into the crates and may have gotten auctioned or whatever, but I don't think they were ever actually practically used because they were all dated historical.
Yeah, this episode is like an obsession. The time that went into like bit by bit pulling all the pieces together, getting all the people in place, and like you said, going above and beyond the normal Call of Duty to prepare an episode, just purely out of love for the original series.
With Ron and Renee and all those guys doing this, this was also, since they had the miniature, I was talking somewhere recently about the poor saga of trying to get the D7 mentioned or drawn again because they kept wanting they kept using the Katinga model and all on Voyager and Enterprise and everything on our show Prophecy and even on Enterprise. And here you finally, they just built one. And it's also the case where not only did you see it, but Ron Moore got the line in where they called it a D7 in dialogue. So D7 was finally retconned in as the name of the, because that, you know, the guy, the fans that had had come up with the D series and that's where that came from. But anyway, that's another case of, that was the thing. The writers were all having fun, you know, sticking stuff in, and they're playing jokes, but also they're, you know, retconning things like that too. That was the biggest one, I think.
You mentioned that, you know, on flashback, you get to have, you know, George and Grace Lee on the show. And of course their link there is Tuvok. But I think what makes this episode work so well for me is that Dax is the link to this time period, and the way that she plays it and the way that she really fits in so well, you know, I mean, her line about, oh, that's right, Leonard McCoy.
Oh, that, I crack up laughing.
I always thought he'd be
he
a
had
doctor.
The hands of a surgeon.
You know, he had the hands of a surgeon. I mean, it's the way that she says it too. She just delivers it in a way that you completely believe that she's reliving the memory of the
Emily
night.
Was a and, you know, like, you know, dated, yeah, you know, yeah.
And not only that delivery, but the look on Sisko's face after she says it. He's like,
yes,
he's like, TMI. Dax, TMI.
Yeah.
Well, and it's at that point that he gets up and he grabs her hand and they walk into the turbo lift and he's like, we've got to get out of here now. Because apparently Dax is willing to mess up continuity here.
Yeah. You're
to
having
go back
too
to
much
McCoy.
Fun, old man.
Well, the thing too, Matthew.
Which sets up the joke of him going, taking the risk of going on the bridge at the end.
Exactly.
Is a story bit. Yeah.
Right.
Matthew, you mentioned Jadzia here and Dax being the connection. But, and Larry, tell me what you think about this. There's a big flaw in this episode, though. Sisko's whole plan to go over the station, massive, massive flaw. I mean, it's really hard to even suspend the disbelief for a moment. With her 3-inch heels and 6-inch hairdo, there is no way that Jadzia is not going to go unnoticed as she walks down the corridors. Everyone on that ship is going to see her and go, well, I don't remember seeing her around here before. She has to be like the most obvious person on the ship.
they're transferring new crew in and out all the time, Chris. Are you
I
kidding?
Think
are you
kidding? If she
oh, you
came
mean just
on
trying
the ship,
to be unobtrusive, yeah,
to be inconspicuous. I mean, if she's walking down the corridor,
it's like an actor coming in the back door of a con trying to walk down a corridor and not you know, and not.
She's
get
the tallest person on the entire ship, and the most attractive.
There's no way that Kirk doesn't walk down that hallway, you know, when they make the turn to talk, and that he doesn't see her out of the corner of his eye and immediately go to talk to her.
Seriously.
Because he's like, I haven't met her yet.
Around.
When he does the headache, when they do the scene with at the speaker with Barriss, you know, I was not aware that 12 Klingons constitute a swarm. That scene, and they've gumped in Sisko and Dax behind them at the panel while they're listening. You don't see off screen that Kirk does do a 180 and does a beeline back.
He's like, I didn't know that 12 Klingons constituted a Can I get back to you?
I'll call you back. Kirk out.
Hold on. I haven't met this hot here. I'll be right back.
Oh, she's in red. Well, and then, get her fast. Yeah.
And that makes sense because you know, they have that nice little scene on the bridge where she gives him kind of the like little nod, and they've already had their moment. So yeah.
Well, that Kirk, he works fast. He's already loved
and
him.
He has his ways.
File your grievance with Starfleet for all I care. No. Yeah. No, what's funny, and here's another thing that's bound up in watching this show, and I hope that when they eventually, when they do get around to remastering and Blu-raying these episodes, that I know they'll probably want to spend some extra time on this like they're doing with some of the Next Gen and even the Enterprise shows so far. But when they do this, I hope they go into the takes and the reels, and I would love to have had this. But it was funny, when they first walked up and gave, and Terry was an original series fan, when they first gave her the tricorder to a prop to play with that day, she, and they had built these. This was like, you couldn't go down and get a Playmates or get a, you know, whatever high end prop recreation or whatever. They were making stuff up and having prop people make them up. And she's holding it. She's basically holding it like she'd hold a, that's what she did. She took one of their Next Gen era, you know, 24th century tricorders where you hold it flat. You know, you unfold the panels and flat. And she was holding it with the front, the top open, and the top, the middle section popped up. But she was holding it flat, basically. And she was rehearsing. They were running lines. And I was going, I hope someone goes out there and tells her, it's not my job. I hope someone tells her to hold it right, upright. You're like, upright, not flat. Like, she's holding it like this, you know, like long ways. And finally, someone stepped out and said, Terry, you hold it like this. And she's like, oh, okay. But I think I wrote about that story. And then she's doing her line about something about James Kirk. He's the most famous captain in Starfleet history. And she, the second or third time they were rehearsing it, or had camera rolling, and she said, he's the most famous captain in Star Trek history. And half the crew laughed, and then she realized what she'd said. And she said, well, he is.
She's right.
Yeah, yeah. But but then I think they do let, when Bashir and O'Brien are over by the little alcove ladder thing, I think one of them is holding it side. Anyway, it was kind of funny that they made a story point out of it or something. But, and you know, and then the story, when you see, he was laughing about it, but they brought David, they had to do a legal thing with David Gerald, work that out, because they were dealing with 60s contracts and something. And if you watch the credits, the way they credit all the actors again, and I think they all got paid for the clips that they used, but, I mean, a few pennies. But aside from Charlie Brill, my God, in finding him, you know, thanks to his son, they had David Gerald on as a guest extra, and he's you know, he's wearing a red shirt. He's a security guard. It's kind of funny, and he's laughing. He was. I remember when we were shooting it. He said, "Yeah, I'm the world's oldest security guard. Like, I must be like a real wimp because I haven't died yet or something." But he brought a '60s Tribble with him, and there's a scene where he's. It just pans around, and he's down petting a Tribble on the floor when they're all like, oh, the crew is in love with the Tribbles now. And the one that he is petting is his 60s Tribble that he brought with him for the shoot. So,
which is the only one in the show, right? Because the rest of them, they actually had to order.
Oh, right.
And then have more made, yeah.
Right. There's actually a... I just realized this too. There was a value added a VAM. There was a bonus feature for the DS9 DVD set, the fifth season set that this episode falls in. And it's kind of funny because at the last second, the attorneys wouldn't let them use it. And I won't tell you why, but if you're ever at a convention where I am and I'm doing my meetup fundraiser party for the Con Arrath, and I don't get this commercial very often, but that's one of the things that I show because I've got a copy of it. And it's nothing outrageous. It just, they're just interviewing, and all the actors and Ira and Ron Moore talk, and they're all kind of having fun and making up this whole thing. But we were so glad to do a Tribble show because Tribbles haven't worked in Hollywood for 30 years. And I was in the movies, and some of them were in line. They were griping about how they hadn't worked, and we thought we'd do this. And Ron's talking about, yeah, we're going to go back and we're going to try to do some new Gunsmoke episodes because some of those horses haven't worked in 30 years. And you know, their agents are calling us. Now. Anyway, it was really funny. But it took a weird turn, and I think – and the attorneys – I think somebody told me the other day, says they'd let this go in a heartbeat now with the new – we've got distance and CBS isn't being as hyper-anal about it, and it's not the 90s anymore. But So if anybody ever sees me at a convention, ask me about that, and I'll try to have it where I can play you the little fun little thing from this. But this show was fun enough as it was without that. I mean, it's just there's just so much. It's just there's so much stuff that even if you just knowing that it's there, if it's not, they took the black plastic wall plaques. They went around. Doug Drexler, Mike Okuda went out and made new ones. And they did to honor, and Bijo Trimble came by, and her real name is Betty Jean Trimble, but her maiden name was McCarthy. And they did a plaque up, like the little crew plaques that would be up and down by the doors. And they did one that said, I have a page of them somewhere, but it said the paper printout, Betty Jean McCarthy, historian, and David Gerald's real name, linguist. And a lot of the guest stars that you knew as crewmen along the way, they would just take the actor's real first name and stick it with the last name and just put those up in the hall. So you got a feeling that it was, they did the same thing they tried to do with the ship models, which was, we couldn't see this in the 60s, but if we got closer, this is what you would see. Mm-hmm. So, but they had just way, 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 way too much fun with it up and down.
Talking about the Tribbles reminds me of one of the great moments in this episode for me. Is between, for the DS9 characters, is between Odo and Worf. And it's the way that Odo talks to Worf. And Michael Dorn is so brilliant in this episode and his reactions to the Tribbles, to the Klingons. I love Michael Dorn when he says, the feeling is mutual. He's going to scream and then he cuts back under his breath. It's so well performed. But Odo's disbelief that the Klingons could be afraid of Tribbles, it was so hilarious. And the delivery of the lines is such a great moment.
Right. And, he has a great delivery.
What's funny too about this? No, I was going to say, I'll shut up because I've been rambling.
This is awesome.
This is a real world thing. That has nothing to do with standing or watching him film it. But it's funny how, in hindsight, even at that time, they were, after they'd done Blood Oath on second season, they were all over them about, come on, explain the bumpy head, smooth head. And you still had people going, oh, come on, we had a bigger budget on the movies, blah, 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 blah. And like, no, it's got to have a canon in universe explanation. And so here you've got no bigger fanboy writers than Ron and Renee. So here's this baby in their lap with a perfect opportunity to bring it up, talk about it, and they decide they want to, and then they all decide, oh my God, we can't bog down this, this Valentine with that. So what do? They hedge it. They think they're throwing out a ha-ha line, and what do they wind up doing? They wound up mucking it up even worse than it was, because they don't realize until later that by having Worf actually talk about it, it was like, okay, There was a thing you've just brought, and the fact that you've had same characters like Korkang and Koloth were flats then bumpy heads. It's just like, made it worse by acknowledging it.
And so they were trying to.
Really? You think it made it worse? I kind of liked that non-explanation line.
Yeah, I kind of liked it too. But the thing is, and when I was watching it again this time, and of course I've seen this episode countless times.
I'm not talking
about
my personal opinion. I'm talking about people that are trying to track the logic of how
people are trying to track logic.
Yeah.
When I watched it this time, though, when he says, they are Klingons, but we don't talk about it with outsiders, I think the line works, except, like you say, Larry, the fact that you do have the same characters. You have Koloth, who we then later see, or actually not later, before this, we had seen Koloth on DS9 with the bumpy head. So that, but accepting the same character part, I always thought it was a cute line. I thought it was funny. I love the way Michael Dorn delivers it.
Oh, yeah. No, the moment's great. It's just for the poor,
but they
canonistas
did,
that are trying to figure it out. And
they did set up material for Enterprise to work with later on when they go to explain what all that really meant.
Yeah, that was a total plan. Yes.
They planned it in 1996. That later on a series called Enterprise, we will reveal what Worf is talking about.
It does make me wonder, though, what they had come up with, and then they were like, okay, we can't bog down this episode with this. It can't become about this. It needs to stay fun. But it really does make me wonder what, Renee and Ira and Ron would have come up with, because those guys were geniuses, I think, when it came to doing that kind of stuff. And I would have loved to have seen their interpretation of that storyline.
where they could have gone with it.
Yeah, to have done it and been able to go all the way with it. Well, see, I have these memories, and one of the memories is the shot where it's Sisko and Dax's first, where they come out of the turbo lift and they're walking down the hall and they do the huge pan with all the extras, and you have the offshoot corridor down the side, and it starts off on them, and then the camera swivels around and you see their point of view, and they're looking at it. So as the audience, you're taking it all in for the first time. And they were coming out of the turbo lift, and they'd built the little tri-laddered thing, alcove, open-air Jeffrey's tube, whatever, off to the, like, to the left side. And I was crammed in there, and Ron and Renee had come over, and we were all, like, crammed up in that together so that the camera could, like, pass by in front of us and track them as it was swiveling, coming by, and catching them. And we were all just back in there, like, being very still and not saying a word. And it was amazing. And the other crazy thing about this was it was like a train wreck or something. It was like, aside from trying to get this done and having the cast and the crew and the, you know, everybody was like on a party atmosphere. And yeah, it does come through. Aside from that, there were people coming to visit. Like Bob Justman came by and visited. And there are all these, you know, celebrities and minor celebrities. And Marina came by to visit. And, you know, just out of the blue. And there's pictures of her with Terry, I think, somewhere. But it was like, Jonathan West is usually the DP, and he was directing, and how he and BC Cameron, and how the poor crew got everybody to actually, you know, at least like the last scene of DS9, you know, the scene in Vic's lounge. I mean, that was kind of like a party day, but at least everybody was sentimental. And it was like, what are they going to do, fire us? But this was a day where it was like, we've got to get the show shot still. People were all having a great time, but we've got to get the show shot. And people were constantly coming by and visiting. And there's, you know, people took a million pictures. And, it's just a goofy. Oh, and the other memory I have of this is like, we were all in that corridor. And I watched how the thing went by, and I knew when the camera would swing around. And David Gerald was... They had put him at a little little red comm panel with the thumb button and the blue comm thing there. And they were just kind of rehearsing. And I said in that article, it was really funny watching BC Cameron talk about the difference between original series extra crew and 24th century extra crew. They walk differently. And they were trying to teach them and how they had concrete floors, and how they realized the first time they had everybody go by, it sounded like a herd of elephants going by, and they had to stop, and they ran, and the costume people ran and got little pieces of felt and glued on the bottom of everybody's boots because it was tromping too loud, and they had to felt everybody's boots. Anyway, so here's the camera coming by, and David was up against the corridor, and he had his like index finger up against, you know, he was standing, leaning in like this. And I was just watching everything. I was like kid in the candy store, just watching everything. And then I realized I was watching the camera shot when they were rehearsing it, and it passed over him, and he was doing that. And I was like, no, 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 wait. And I waited till it was done, and they were in between things. I just was like kind of like waving at him like 8-10 feet away. And I'm like, David, David, David. He's like, what, what? And I go, you don't do the index finger. You do your thumb. He's like, oh, right, right, right. Because anyone knows on the original series, you didn't hit one of those with your index. Well, you might have broken the set piece. You did it with a thumb. It was a thumb punch when you did that. So, you know.
Or if you're Kirk and then you're on the bridge.
You just slam
right.
It with your fist. Right. But he wasn't Kirk. So anyway, so I said David was doing some kind of documentary. He had a crew doing a thing about him and his work one time. And that was my story for their documentary, was that I got to direct David Gerald in Trials and Tribulations.
I just see Larry. Awesome. Larry is on the set of Trials and Tribulations, and he's just a nervous wreck because every little detail about the original series, it's not exactly right, but you can't say anything, right? You're like...
No,
it's not my place. It's not my place.
That was an exception. No, there were. Are you kidding me? There's like 40 or 50. You had your 5 or 6 or 10 uber nerds. You had Ron and Renee and, you know, Mike Akuta and Denise and all those guys. And then the crew had all become uber nerds by then, and fans, and sweating every little, you know, like chair and, you know, Bob Blackman in the costume. I mean, all of that stuff. So. It was and the Klingons in the bar scene were wearing. This is something that's kind of makes total sense. There's so few. I think they found third season, you know, crew uniforms because they were acrylic, and they've got completely original. And they're on the tours shows too. The Klingon pants and tops and all that, they were metallic fabrics. If it was the velour stuff from the early seasons, it's all gone to dust. But if it was a metallic weave thing, And, you know, and Bill Tice loved to use those 60s woohoo mod looking things. So they had some Klingons in some original series Klingon costumes.
That's cool.
He made, and that was when they, the secret of the Klingon belt buckle was bubble pack padding, you know, turned over, and the dots were the bubble pack. But that was when a lot of that stuff was coming out for the first time, and it's funny to watch the pros doing it. Like, not today, you'd say, oh, they were like, you know, prop boys or fanboys or cosplayers or something. But it was, this was like the staff doing the research with this beautiful, you know, and stuff that beautiful color print was revealing for the first time that now we take for granted. You know, that you can see. And nobody had thought to look that close or tried to, or some fan sitting there with their 35 millimeter clip that was faded trying to, you know, get it out. And here they were all doing it on pay, on schedule, and had been doing it for months and months. And it's just amazing. It's just funny. But you know, one of the total side products, byproducts of that show was the fact that everybody went, you know, if we cleaned up all the shows like this, we might sell some new ones. And, you know, planning an idea.
That's one of the things that I did want to touch on for a minute is the road to remastered TOS that this episode and creation of this episode, I think, did make them realize that not only was there a market for it, but it was actually feasible that they could go in and clean up the entire series and remaster all 80 episodes of TOS.
Yeah.
Yeah, and thank goodness, because I love those.
Yeah, and the job that they did, too. I mean, you could tell that they had learned what you could do with, you know, trials and tribulations and how you could clean up the trouble with Tribbles. And then, of course, you know, when they actually started doing it, it's later on down the road, so they've learned even more about cleaning up negatives like that. And, you know, you've seen so many films come out in the last like 10, 15 years where they've gone through and meticulously recreated the film and given it that just beautiful look. And it looks better than it probably did when it came out the first time. And, you know, you watch these episodes now and it really does have that look that you would have had if you were looking through the camera shooting the episode. And it hadn't looked as that good since, you know, the director was looking at it the first time. And I think, you know, that makes it so beautiful is that by doing this episode, I think they showed just how good TOS was.
Yeah.
And it helped revive a lot of fans, I think, love for TOS in a way that nothing else had in a long time. And I know it did for me. I mean, you know, I grew up watching the reruns on TV, but this made me want to see them again because I remembered how much fun TOS really was.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I remember first watching this episode and thinking, good gosh, I've not watched the original series in a long time. And of course, this is before DVDs are out, and getting access to these older episodes is a lot harder than it is today. And back then, I think I didn't have them. Unless they were showing them as a rerun on TV, I was not seeing them. And it made me really nostalgic for that era.
Yeah, we get so used now to just punching up whichever episode we want to watch, right? And the computer, just, I want to watch this one, here it is. But yeah, back then we're catching them as they happen to be on television.
It's the wall of tapes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Unless I had it on VHS tape.
I used to record them all on VHS tape, yeah.
Oh, you know it.
But that was a process. Took a lot of time.
Right.
When I was a little kid and I had my first tape recorder, we used to like record cassette tapes off TV because that's all you could do. And you would have like cassette. People were selling those in the back of Trek Mag. What you were saying, Matthew, it just made me start. I mean, there's always – it dawned on me as a few years had gone by that it was funny to me how in the when TNG was at its height and it was the foamiest and there was so much – there were so many, you know, wannabe fans and poser fans, and the popularity of TNG in the first movies and Voyager's launch and DS9, like 94, 95, it was like the height. And people were poo-pooing the original series back then. And it was really funny. Oh, no, I'm a fan of Next Generation. Oh, I love Picard and Data. Oh, I can't stand to watch the original series. Oh, those cardboard sets. Oh, those plywood sets. Those Christmas light controls. Oh, you know, oh, those cheesy effects. I just can't, it just blows the realism for me. I can't stand to watch it. And somewhere By the time of Enterprise, everything became, oh, the 60s is so retro cool, and oh, mm-hmm. TNG is so 80s with a counselor on the bridge and the Hyatt Regency in space and carpet on the walls. Oh my God, it's so 80s. Oh, give me the original series. Give me Kirk was so bitchin'. Oh, the babes. Ooh. And somewhere in there, the pendulum swung. No, I'm serious. And both times I would be defending the other one. You know, it's like, they're all kids. They're all books on the shelf. Shut up. But it's like it was partly generational, but by the time of the aughts, we had people being, you know, they were burned out on Next Gen, and they were like, oh, and the whole retro cool idea, and then you set the stage. I think that's partly why Bad Robot and the guys, they went with that as their way out of the box of what to do fresh. But I never stopped to think about when that might have actually swung, and you're right, Matthew, it might have been things like this. It might have been seeing this, planting the seeds of that, because it turned. It was really weird to me how just within 5, 6, 7 years you went from TOS bashing to TNG bashing. And or at least the loud vocal people on the, you know.
Yeah, it just depended on what kind of a hipster you were before there were hipsters.
Yeah. And but like I said, I used to defend original series. I'll say, no, this is, you wouldn't have had this now if you didn't have the original series. Shut up. Go watch the stories. Like McCoy at the end of Journey to Babel. Shut up. And then, and then you had, yeah, then you had the uber hipsters coming along, second wave, going, oh, you know, therapist on the bridge, how 80s. I was just really sick of that. Yes, it was a conscious decision, you know, but you may have pegged where the turnaround started. That's interesting.
Well, there's, I mean, you know, you watch through each one of the shows, and there's a strength that each show has, and there's also a glaring weakness really that each show has, and each one is like that, and you know, we just accept them, I think, as fans. If you really love something, you're gonna let those kind of things go, and you know, TOS is fantastic, but it has some of its cheesiness that, you know, and some of its things that we wish weren't there, but hey, that's fine, you know, and it doesn't all fit together perfectly, but it's a TV show, and we need to get a life and stop taking it so seriously, as Shatner would say. But, you know, TNG is like that. It has those things that we can look back now and we're like, oh, wow, you know, maybe that wasn't the best idea creatively, but, you know, in the end, it's still great. It gave us great characters who love Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. Voyager, Enterprise. They're all the same, I love, though, that this whole episode, and every time I probably watch this episode the most of any Star Trek show, just because when I pop it in, it is that love letter to the fans. You know, it's saying, we love this, you love this, and let's just have a great time both loving something. And they did the best that they could do, and it was amazing. And I'm really glad that they gave us this episode. I mean, I can't imagine this not existing and maybe that year only getting something like Flashback, because this took it to a whole nother level, especially with just what they did with TV and the effects that they were doing, building new models. I mean, this just blows my mind that this is a TV episode, but we're going to do all of this work for it because we love this show so much.
And for modern fan, you get two episodes in one, really. I mean, you it's exactly. Almost like you can rewatch exactly. Trouble with Tribbles in the wrapped in the envelope of, now that I think about it that way. It's
well, when I go back now, when I watch The Trouble with Tribbles, when Kirk is there and the Tribbles are falling on his head, you know, I always imagine that Sisko and Dax are up there throwing Tribbles down at him.
Just a few feet away from him, yeah, above him, yeah.
Because when he looks up, when he said before he says, "Close this door," I am thinking, oh my God, he's looking up. He's gonna see Dax. That's what I'm feeling like. He's gonna see
right up her.
Her
skirt. He's gonna
yeah.
Well, you know he didn't, because if he could, the last thing he would say would be
exactly.
He didn't
still
notice
words out yeah. of her mouth.
Can somebody open this
yeah.
door wider?
No, they. But what's funny is the way they. Yeah. But what's funny is the way they time, those last couple uh-huh. to fall. They the way they cut back and forth, and those last It's like the old joke of, you know, like the Fibber McGee's closet when it would crash, 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 and you had that tinkly, 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 like the hubcap rolling away or something. You know, that last yeah. sound to be the punchline on the radio joke of a noise and or a sound effect joke. And like that last one or two triples, and was that the last ones? And no, there's one more falling on him. And they played with that on the Dax and Cisco side.
Right. There's the moment where Jadzia tosses one over her shoulder.
Yes.
And then it comes yeah. down and it hits Kurt.
Yeah.
The way they cut it together was really, yeah. It was very cute.
But the two episodes and one from another angle. And Matthew, as my co-host from The Orb, I wanted to ask you what you thought about how they handled this. What I do love here is that although your focus on all this is K7, it is the whole Tribble story, I love the fact that they had to find a way to make this work as a DS9 episode.
Yes.
And they did it by tying it in to the ongoing story with the orbs and the Orb of Time. And you really do feel, and the way they cut back to Kira on the Defiant, you really do feel that this is a Deep Space Nine episode that's taking place, and they're just telling you the story of what happened to them.
Yeah, it's fantastic that instead of giving us a lot of like crazy techno babble to get us there, which is what Flashback does, and it's its biggest mistake, in that the techno babble doesn't even make sense. Here, you have a ready-made, you know, time travel device. It's an orb. We already understand those. We know they're mysterious. They work in mysterious ways, as you two would say. And so, you know, it's a perfect way to bring us back to this time without having to really explain it to us. And I think what makes this the Deep Space Nine episode is that all the characters are on their game. They're all having the best time. You know, like we talked about earlier, O'Brien and Bashir are on every mm-hmm. cylinder here. Their bromance is just working like clockwork. I mean, they're making fun of people. Bashir is not sure if he needs to be his own great-grandfather or grandfather, you know. I mean, which is one of the funniest things
after
ever,
the
you know, when
the
he looks
lift.
At...
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, when he's looking at, but he looks at Miles and he goes, "You're gonna be sorry when we get back to Deep Space Nine and you realize I don't exist." And Miles just looks at him and is like,
"Okay,
like I can live with that." I mean, it's perfect. And then again, you know, them tying it into Dax and the fact that she's lived through this time period, and she even has the whole speech as she's like, I lived through this time period. I loved this time period, and it's hard to not
I love
get
the
caught
black
up in
and the
again.
Chrome accents.
And it's
yes. yes. classic 23rd century design.
Yes.
It reminds me that this is the fans in the writer's room saying, "I lived through this time. I remember watching this, you know, in college or when it was first on." And you can just feel that coming through. And this makes it a Deep Space Nine story for me, though, because they focus on the Deep Space Nine characters and they let us know new things about them and they let them have a good time. And so I'm not blowed over just by the special effects and the fact that I'm seeing Kirk meet Sisko. I'm more excited the fact that Sisko is meeting Kirk. Mm-hmm. You know, it's
right,
the other way
yeah.
around. Like my character, the one I love right now, is meeting the one that I still love from the past. And they just do that
yeah,
perfectly.
Definitely. And also, in Lexley and Dahmer, this episode gives us two characters that get to live on, because now in Christopher Bennett's Temporal Investigations book series, we have these two characters.
And they're fantastic. Like, you wouldn't think these
oh, that's
two,
right. yes,
like,
yes.
kind of boring characters, yeah, but they turn out to be fantastic literary characters in,
well,
in Bennett's books.
I haven't read any of those. Okay, well, now you've almost made me want to read them. Okay.
Oh, Dahmer, you'll love them, Larry. The way that Christopher Bennett is able to weave every single time travel episode in somehow, it would be a gold mine for you. I think you'd
which everyone knows, and I hope it's old hat, but just to point out that when they did that, they did as another sign of the times when the X-Files was so big, Dahmer and Luxley are anagrams for Mulder
right.
and Scully, which yeah. I hope everybody's up with. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But that's great too. I mean, there's just so much in this episode to enjoy.
Another cool thing was Gary Monack was their live effects guy, so he was doing like the squibs and explosions and all those kinds of things. But he also like Jim Rugg did on the original series. He was the one when they had to have mobile tribbles. And it just blew me away after, if you were a kid and you had the Making of Star Trek book and you've got the picture in there that Stephen Poe or Stephen Whitfield took his black and white pictures and showed you how they made tribbles and how they would take a wind up, you know, they take a wind up animal and strip off the outer thing and just stick the tribble ball over it. But they use the little plasticky metal armature of the creeping legs, like a wind up toy, right? And they did the exact same thing here. I love going in. He made a pile of about 10 or 12 of wind-up. And he did the same thing. He went in and got wind-up animals, fuzzy, you know, soft fur animals, stripped off the outside thing, covered them in some of the fur, you know, the triple fur that they had done up for just stuffed ones. And I took two pictures where he had a pile of them on the corner of his workbench. And they're all like that. And then we took the same picture and we just turned all of them upside down in the pile to show the legs sticking out and the cranks, you know, the wind-up crank, little wind-up stems. Because it just killed me. It was kind of like, yes, it's like the more things change, the more they don't. And they're doing the wind-up triples yeah. are exactly the same in 96 as they are in 66. It was just
That's cool that they kept it that authentic.
It was the best way to do it. It was about being authentic. It was like, there's no other better way to do it still. Let's just do it the same
still,
way.
Still, yeah. yeah. Classic technology, as Dax would say. another thing we didn't talk about here was the Vulcan connection to this story, because the, you know, the Klingon belts were Velcro, and, you know, Velcro being new at the time. And it's thanks to the Vulcans that the costume designers in the 60s had Velcro, because if T'Pol hadn't provided everyone with Velcro,
right? In
Thank
the late
goodness
50s,
for that.
We wouldn't have had Project Mercury, much less, or something.
Much less Klingon uniforms with Velcro belts.
Right?
They would have had to find something else to make them out of.
I didn't think I needed another reason to be thankful for T'Pol and her family line. Now I do.
Totally.
Now you do. All right, well, we've been talking trials and tribulations for about an hour, so let's go ahead and wrap up with final thoughts, or in the case of Larry, final trivia bits that maybe you didn't share yet that you want to throw out there to everyone.
This has so much going for it. You are essentially watching two episodes, as we mentioned before. You're watching the iconic Trouble with Tribbles and meshing that with this Deep Space Nine episode. Also incredibly good in its own right for all the reasons we've talked about. I don't know if you get a whole lot better than this. I think I said the same thing last week about Inner Light, but really, I think this is the height of Deep Space Nine for me. It's just so much fun. There's so much attention to detail. There's so much to appreciate in everything about this rich story. Very, very much at the top. Just so incredibly well done. And it shows. The appreciation that everybody put in to this episode definitely comes through. If we're going to rate it, I think I might give it 10 uniforms, TOS style.
You know, I think for Deep Space Nine, this was the moment that you knew that Star Trek probably couldn't get any better. The writing staff on a show couldn't get any better. That the collection of people that was there, this episode is lightning in a bottle, and it's never going to happen again, and it never does on any of the shows. I don't think that any of them, just the love and care that has gone into it, really gets any better. But for me, too, it cemented the fact that Deep Space Nine was always going to be my favorite show, because it's the show that not only gave me my favorite captain, it gave me my favorite episodes from any of the series, but it also just gave me the knowledge that the writing staff behind this loved all of Star Trek, and that they were putting their heart and soul into everything they were going to do. And, you know, season 5 just continues on to be fantastic. Season 6 and season 7 create some of the best that Star Trek has ever done. And this was the episode where I knew I was going to love Deep Space Nine the most. And I just wanted it then to end well, and it does. And this episode here, I've watched it more than any other episode of Star Trek, and I can't think of anything more that you could want from a TV show than to want to be able to pop in an episode and watch it anytime and always have a good time watching it. And so I guess if I had to rate this episode, wow, I don't even know if I could rate, other than to say out of 10, I would give this 10 Terry Farrells.
All right, literally.
The we were talking about the turbo lift girl. They called her the Deck 15 girl because the actresses they had come in reading the lines couldn't say Deck 15 right, the way you would do it in Star Trek, just as a commanding elevator. They actually wrote that second. There was a second scene with her. They came up short, and they wrote that, and they hadn't cast the part. And Renee Echevarria just had a friend, an actress friend of his, the Deidre Imershein, that's the credited person. It was a little tiny part, but they needed someone that could carry it, and she was a good actress that had a lot of stage background. And he called, but she was a huge fan, and she was on Captain's Holiday. I'm seeing her now too. She was the Ricean Pleasure Girl on Captain's Holiday.
Oh, but really? Okay.
On nice. Like no time, he called her and said, "Would you come in and do this little bitty turbo lift scene? Cause it's hysterical, and we just need someone that can do it for real. And you get to wear a blue skirt." And she's like, "Oh yeah, I'd love to." So that was like a quickie. And the Dax McCoy tie-in was a late. I'm just reading some of my original notes here. That was a late. That was a late add too. The tying in. The other thing about the show is we find it, that's a cool bit when you find Emily Dax, right? Jadzia's Dax's earlier host, dated, slept with. However, she enjoyed McCoy's surgeon hands. But if you stop and step back, all the canonistas get to know that we know that at least it was the 2240s or whatever that Trills and humans, you know, the Trills had contact with the Federation. Uh-huh. Would go back that far because yeah. You can't hide the spots. But one of the rereading this, one of the cool things was there was actually one of the gaffers. He was like a year or two away from retirement, and his name was Ed Cooper, and he was working the show. And someone pointed me over to him, and I talked to him, and I wish I had talked to him more later on, but he actually was working at Desilu and worked on the original series. And not only did he light Star Trek, but he lit the Tribbles show. So here he is like 30 years later.
Yeah.
And wow. I've always felt very, he was kind of a gruff old guy, but I got him to talking and he talked. And I've always felt horrible because when I wrote this piece, I did a brain freeze and I short circuited and I called him in the text here. I called him Ed Brooks, which was a government professor I'd had in college. And I just did I screwed up his last name. I went from Cooper to Brooks, and I always felt very bad about it, and I corrected it the next time, but it was like, no. But my lasting thing about this show is, you know, we just did you were laughing about it at the beginning, we just did Star Trek Continues, and I got to, on 3 weeks' notice, I got to go in and play McCoy, and we got there, it was a horrible traffic day on Sunday, and they were going to start shooting first thing Monday morning, and they pushed it back 2 hours because a couple of us got in late. But my memory is when I hadn't gone over the stages, and they're building, it's shared with the Farragut fan film. So they've got a stage 9 corridor, curved corridor with sick bay and all the sets along. And then the bridge is setting by itself at the end of that. And when you walk in the main end and start walking down, you go by sick bay, and they had just built a sick bay room and they were very proud of it. And you walked in, and first it was like, well, here's the corridors and they've got the lights on and it looks beautiful. And he kind of go, oh. And then I take two steps. I look to the side. I can look in the sick bay. And then they've got a Leonard McCoy MD plastic black sign, you know, 60s looking sign there on the thing, like original series. And I was like, oh. And I had my best little, you know, fanboy nerdgasm there of the moment. And what flashed in my head was watching Trials and Tribulations film. I mean, somebody later on was laughing. They said, so, did it remind you of the 60s? Like, ha, 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 old guy. And I was laughing. And I said, no, I was not there in the 60s. I said, but what it did remind me of was when I first walked on stage and walked down early in the morning, was walking around with Laura Richards. and she was making her set decorators rounds, and I first walked in and I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Just the corridors look, because nothing like that had ever been done. I didn't see the Relic show on Next Gen, but even then it was just a couple of, it was a very tiny pie shape of the bridge they did. This was so overblown, and when I walked in the Continues sets, I flashed back to that. So it was so it was a pleasant thing on both ends. Very, yeah. Very cool.
Very much so.
That was, I'll give it 10 memory engrams. How about that? Okay. Good memory engrams.
Excellent. So I'll keep my wrap up short. For me, watching this episode reminds me how, as Star Trek fans, we, depending on our age, we expect different things out of Star Trek. And we, you know, some of us saw all the episodes in first run. Some of us have only seen things on DVD. Some people have only seen even Next Generation on DVD. But for me, I grew up watching TOS reruns in the 70s. I'm not quite old enough to have seen it in first run, but I caught it just when it started in reruns. So I grew up watching the original series for a long time before The Next Generation came around. So when we finally got to this episode, the impact, the very first time it came on television, of seeing the Enterprise on the view screen, Matthew, like you said, got you as well. And seeing the corridors, Larry, I didn't get to see them firsthand like you did, but seeing them on the screen was an amazing experience. And you could just really feel the love of the writers for all of Star Trek. And I said at the beginning that this is a Valentine to Star Trek. And I know they say at the end of Enterprise, they were trying to make a Valentine to Star Trek with These Are the Voyages. But really, Trials and Tribulations is a Valentine to Star Trek, and it's a really wonderful one. And so I watched this episode over and over, and I always spot new things every time I watch it. And it just doesn't get much better for this for a Star Trek fan. And so I'm going to give this episode 10 ecological menaces to the Empire.
Nice.
All right. Well, it's been a great discussion. Right. So before we go, Char, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
All right. You can find me, of course, all over the place at Trek FM, and especially on To the Journey.
To the Journey.
To the Journey.
Very nice. With my wonderful co-hosts, Lori and Tristan. And then, of course, you can find me also on Twitter. My handle is Oh the Profanity.
Great. And Larry, where can people find you?
My LarryNemechek.com is kind of the central hub, and my Trekland blog has a portal there, and that's where you can also see about good old Con of Wrath, my documentary, and my Twitter is just simply at LarryNemechek, and I have my Larry Nemechek Trekland Facebook page, and I'm still about a month away from being able to say it, actually, but we're still working on the official licensed canon nonfiction Trek book that'll be out for the holidays, as this great revival of nonfiction is happening in a lot of places. And Star Trek Continues, and I played McCoy, and is going to world premiere at Phoenix Comic Con over Memorial Day weekend. So before that, I feel like I'm on The Tonight Show. a new convention in El Paso called Sun City Sci-Fi is the end of this month. And a new little convention in L.A. called BlasterCon, which is about 70s and 80s fandoms and franchises. Mother's Day weekend in L.A. And then the end of June at SoonerCon back home in Oklahoma City. And then San Diego Comic-Con and Vegas Trek. And our Star Trek film sites tour, the Hollywood to Vegas tour, is still taking people at geeknationtours.com. And I think I got everything in.
Wow. Larry, I think you're in an exposure competition with Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
Oh. Hey, is that in public or in private? But I'll let Jeff expose himself in public. Oh. And also I still have my Trekland CDs that you very graciously helped me with the art direction and remastering on, Chris. I want to keep mentioning those. And if you want to help Con of Wrath, I have about 5 left of the Klingon pads that were cast from a screen-used pad that a donor did 10 of them for. And so you can see that at the site. Actually, that's not on site. You have to see me personally to get that. But I just want to say after all that I don't know when I've been smiling more through any podcast, much less one of yours, as I have through this one. It just made me think about a lot of stuff I hadn't thought about in a long time. And and digging these guys out of the drawer and everything else was kind of a real hoot tonight. So thanks a lot for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us.
Well, Chris, that was just fantastic. One, for me, I finally got to meet the doctor of Star Trek, Larry Nemechek himself, face-to-face in the best Star Trek way possible by, you know, meeting over the internet with...
Using technology.
You know, video.
That's right.
Which is fantastic. Yeah, it was just like a Star
Trek
episode.
We had our view screens going.
It was a lot of fun.
Activate view screen.
Exactly.
It was fun, and Larry has so much fantastic... background information about Trials and Tribulations. The fact, you know, this was the time period when he was really able to be on the sets a lot. And there's so much in this episode. You can watch it over and over and over, and you can see new things every single time. And then after reading, well, I read Larry's article way back in the day when it was written, and then I read it again recently, just the other day to get ready for this episode of The Ready Room. And then when I watch Trials and Tribulations and look for all these little details again, I keep getting more and more out of this episode. It's really incredible. And speaking of that article that Larry referenced a number of times during the discussion, there is a PDF copy of it over on Trekland, on Larry's Trekland blog, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes if you want to go check it out. It's very extensive. It was in the Communicator back in, I want to say it was 97, but back then it was incredible.
Yeah, I read it this afternoon. It really is good. I suggest that everybody go through and read that because you'll really feel like you were there in creating this episode. And Larry shares a lot of things there that we didn't have time to get to talk about tonight. And so it really is fantastic.
It's very, very detailed. Absolutely. Well, Matthew, let's tell everyone where to find us if they'd like to share their thoughts on Trials and Tribulations, on anything we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and send to the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also go to our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Ready Room. There's one for Deep Space Nine. And you can talk to us about anything we talked about on the show and talk with other fans as well. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course on Twitter under username trekfm. And Matthew, what if people would like to look you up personally?
Well, if you'd like to find me on the interwebs, if you're just perusing around, you can check me out on Twitter at mattrushing02. And as well, I am here on Trek FM doing book reviews, doing The Orb, our Deep Space Nine podcast, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine. So if you enjoyed hearing about Trials and Tribulations, it's a perfect place to join, especially if you're a Niner, or if you just need Chris and I to convince you to be a Niner. That's the show for you. And then, of course, we also do Literary Treks, where we talk about books and comics. You know, hopefully one day soon we will get a chance to talk about the Temporal Investigations novels that we talked a little bit about on this show.
That would be cool, because those are quite fun.
So those are the places to find me. But Chris, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. So give me a follow and give me a shout and let me know that you followed. And we can talk about Star Trek and whatever you want to talk about. I tweet about many different subjects. And you can also find me from time to time on the network here on my show Matterstream, which is an interview show. It's not a regular show, but from time to time when I do have a nice topic with scientists, creatives, actors, other people to talk about things very loosely related to Star Trek, you can find that over there at trek.fm/ms. And also, Matthew, we want to invite everyone to take advantage of that great offer from our sponsor, Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK4 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And you'll be getting the best hosting and the best CMS available. It's absolutely the easiest way to create a website, a personal blog, a portfolio, or an online store. You will love Squarespace. I certainly do. And just go check it out, and you'll be helping us bring this programming to you every week. Well, Matthew, I need some food and I need a drink, so I'm going to head back over to the bar on K7 and ask that waitress if they've gotten any Ractigino yet.
Chris, that sounds like a fantastic idea. And I think it's time to stick a chrome-plated tricorder in it, because the ready room is done. What music are we going to choose?
Okay. Boom, chicka, bam, bam, I'm not boom, sure boom, yet, so we'll think about that.
You could just have me doing it. And just...
I'll have you singing Armageddon tonight.
Fly me to the moon. You sing among the stars. Let me sing what it's like on Jupiter and Mars. Anyway, okay. Sorry. That's going to go at the end of the show, damn it.